everyone. Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. Today we are discussing the 1994 novel Insomnia. It came out on September 15th that year, and it does tie into the Dark Tower series a little bit, but I have to admit, at the top of this episode here, I got a little lost, so I'm sure Katie will be doing some more of the explaining this time around. But Katie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. And I've read this book a few times, so I feel confident in knowing kind of what's happening.
Do you find his books are easier to understand once you've had a chance to read it, spend some time with it, reread it, and sort of just make your way through at least a second or third time to pick up details maybe you didn't pick up your first read through?
Yes. Definitely. Especially something like this, where the plot that's happening is really complicated. You know, like some of his stuff, you can just, like Christine, no, not a whole lot there. But this one, yeah, I read it initially like a decade ago, but I remembered a lot of it. And I think I read it twice then. So a lot of this book was like, oh yeah, I remember this happening. And then anticipating, I think I know the ending, you know, that type of scenario.
It's funny that you brought up Christine, because King does have a lot of books like that where it's just evil thing comes to town. And so you have the evil car, Christine, you have Cujo, the evil dog with rabies and goes crazy. And then you have, you know, Pennywise, the evil clown. And while I will admit that it is a much more complicated book than Cujo or Christine, there's a simplicity in the plot.
Exactly. Like you said, evil thing comes to town. And then there's lots of things built up around that. But this book really goes and shoots for the stars with how much is going on and how closely you have to pay attention to what's going on in order to really get that understanding before the end comes, when he finally explains everything, because it's a slow build. This one is such a slow build. I don't think we really get to the end and like things start really happening until 2/3 of the way through the book or so.
In that respect, it felt a little like Tommyknockers as far as how much setup was done, but it was done much better than Tommyknockers, so
yeah,
it worked out better in the end. And you know, speaking of Pennywise and the It story, this takes place in Derry, so you have that connection. And I'm pretty sure Mike Hanlon comes up as still being the librarian at least 2 or 3 times in this.
Yep, yep. He's a small character in the book. Yep. And there's a couple of other things in it that obviously, like the geography, you know, Witcham Street and Kansas Street and all of that are present in the book. And I think they talk about the giant flood in 85, which is the very ending of it.
Uh-huh.
And they talk about that pretty regularly and how it changed the town. There's moments where Ralph, you know, thinks about how Derry has changed since then, but it's still not a good place.
Yeah, it's something that has affected the town in such a negative way that it kind of not necessarily became a dump, but you could tell that there just isn't really a good vibe with this town at all. And to dive into the main story here a little bit, Ralph Roberts is our main character who suffers from insomnia after his wife dies, which I think is something that King took as a normal response to this trauma that has happened, but he twisted it in a way to bring these fantasy elements into it. And it was done in such a cleverful way that you can't help but be engrossed by Ralph's story. And I think a lot of that setup with him going and meeting Lois, them getting married, that's what really caught my attention with this story at the beginning. And it wasn't until later, when they brought in the little bald doctors, whose names I probably won't even try to pronounce. If you have an idea, feel free. But once they were introduced, I was like, hold on, what's going on here? And I was getting bits and pieces of it, but by the end, it just didn't quite come together like I was hoping, at least in my mind, because I felt like there was just some piece of knowledge that I was missing. And I don't know if that's because of how heavily Greek mythology plays into this, because I'm not super familiar with that.
Yeah, there's, I think that there is so much going on here that isn't hinted at until, like I said, pretty far away. Like the bald doctors, you don't find out what's going on with them, with Clothos, Atropos, and I can't find the name of the last one.
I think it's Lachesis.
Lachesis.
Yes. Okay.
Yep. Which are the three fates who spin everyone's lifeline in Greek mythology. That's kind of what they are in this too.
That makes sense.
Yeah. They are usually there are three women. So that's an interesting change up. But I think Ralph is such an interesting character and a kind of character that we don't see very often in any books. You know, this is something where he's a 70-year-old man and has this trauma, and then
he certainly lived a full life up until this point too, and yet this story gives you so much more of it to come.
Right. And he just kind of gets thrown into this adventure, and we really get to see him react as someone who has lived this full life. He's not a child like in It. And I thought that added such an interesting dimension, and at least in the beginning, the limitations of him, where he's a 70-year-old man. So it's not like he's running down the street to get away from something, because right. He might fall and break his hip. Yeah, like there is a lot of the Greek mythology going on in this story. And I think the beginning, the setup with him having the insomnia and then seeing the auras and then realizing that they're real, as opposed to a hallucination that he's experiencing because of getting 2 hours of sleep a night. Because that is something that does happen to you if you yeah. have insomnia. You do start to hallucinate if it goes on long enough. So I felt like he took a lot of the real in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, just twisted it a little bit. So, and I think that's done really well and makes it work. But it does also keep you guessing for probably a little too long whether or not this is really happening.
Right. And Ralph certainly seems very self-aware of everything that's happening with him. And he tries to go to people for help. He doesn't really talk to his primary physician about it, but he goes to this other doctor and kind of talks it out. And the guy is like, you should tell your regular doctor this. And he's kind of not wanting to because he's worried about how absurd it would sound probably. And then he goes to, you know, one of the local cops for help. And, you know, they seem to be old friends. So he's kind of just like, you know, go get help. Go figure this thing out. Because it's very clear to a lot of people that he's not sleeping. They just don't know about the auras and the little bald doctors and everything else that Ralph is seeing. So he tries to keep it pretty contained. But then once he finds out that Lois is also seeing the same things, I think that really is where their connection starts to build up. And you can tell it's just sort of this natural thing for both of them. And I really like that aspect of the story too. Just the two of them meeting, getting to know each other, and then sharing this thing that they can't share with anyone else.
Right. And it's like they're chosen. Obviously, they were chosen for this task.
Yeah.
And in the beginning of the book, it talks about how he has feelings-ish or like possible proto-feelings for Lois. And he kind of is like, well, maybe I could ask her out on a date or something. But he doesn't feel compelled to. I mean, his wife has only died recently. Then it works so well because they already have this like almost, or they have a pre-established relationship, and then they get pushed over into something much more intense and requires them to work together and understand each other on this literally an entirely different level, according to the book, like mentally. And I did really enjoy the fact that you don't get any information about what Lois is going through until that pivotal scene in the park where Atropos cuts Rosalie's lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
And that works really well because it's all of this dramatic tension all released at once.
Yeah, and it's safe to say that Ralph and Lois both think that these fates are sort of the villains of the story. And really, in the end, it's Atropos who shines through as the one causing all of these problems and sort of deciding these things that Ralph and Lois think they shouldn't be able to decide. And that's where the tension, I think, really starts to show in those three characters in particular.
Right. I think it's a very interesting twist that, because in Greek mythology, the three fates are like all work together in tandem, and each one's job is equally important to the human life. And one of them spins the yarn, the other one pulls out the length, and the third one snips it at the end. And it's an interesting concept to have one of them be, you know, part of the random and they're part of the purpose, and to kind of split them into two groups and allow one of them to be the... It's really complicated because, like, he feels like a bad guy. He feels like a bad guy, but he is serving, and he is a bad guy in this book, but he is serving a purpose, like...
This higher purpose that normal humans would not understand.
Right. You know, and to us, it would be like he's always bad, but on that higher level that they're talking about of how the world or the, you know, the universe runs, like somebody has to do it, and he enjoys it, which is really terrible, but it's also necessary. And that's such an interesting juxtaposition to think about. And it feels so much more real. And then you have him being corrupted by the Crimson King, which is the entity from the Dark Tower that has come into our world. That's my understanding of what's going on there, is that the Crimson King found an opportunity to come into our world to affect the overarching pattern of how everything connects.
Let's dive into the ties to the Dark Tower a little more here, because you brought up the Crimson King, and then there are different levels of the tower, and that's where sort of the purpose and random comes in, and this is the first time we're being introduced to that concept. So you have these driving forces that are apparently on the different levels of the tower. So we're sort of just touching a very small piece of the tower in this story. And going into it, I had no idea about the ties to the Dark Tower, but I'm reading Rose Matter now, and it's like that is also kind of tying into the Dark Tower. So there are more Dark Tower books than King has labeled, essentially, because you have The Stand, you have this, then you have Rose Matter almost immediately after this, or immediately after this, actually, I think. And then who knows how many more of his books will have these little tidbits. But I feel like with Insomnia, you're getting even more important information than maybe what we get from The Stand about the Dark Tower.
Yes. And I have been told that, because I, again, haven't read the last book, that this ties in incredibly heavily with the last book. Like, it is something that you should read if you're reading the Dark Tower series. That's kind of how it's important side material, we'll say, because it gives you more background. But the connections to the tower kind of very slowly creep in. And I wonder what someone would think if this is like the first Stephen King book they picked up. Like, I feel like
I would feel bad.
Right? If you've been reading King for a long time, like, even if you've never read any of the Dark Tower books, like, you're kind of aware of the tower as a thing, and you've seen Roland mentioned, because he's mentioned a couple times in this one, never in any real capacity, but he's talked about, and you've heard him mentioned, and you've seen other things in that kind of hint that there's some other bigger world going on in the background of all of King's books. But if you read this one, you'd be like, why do I care about this kid? What? So, but if you've read any of his other stuff, like, I feel like this is a really rewarding read in that, because of how well it manages to take the Dark Tower mythos and bring it into his other books and help it really flesh out how his universe works. Like you said, like, the tower has the levels, and this gives a different metaphorical reading on what those levels are and how the tower exists in all dimensions, I guess that's the word we'll go with, mm-hmm. dimensions.
I feel like that's the only word that might suffice, because when it comes to the fantasy elements of King's storytelling, fantasy isn't necessarily my favorite genre. I mean, the most I've dug into fantasy really is like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings and some of Neil Gaiman stuff. So it's not like I'm an avid fantasy reader by any means. I got into King because of his horror elements, and I felt enough of that in this book for it to kind of keep me wanting to figure out what happens at the end. But I feel like because I've only started The Dark Tower and I don't really know how this ties in yet, it made it a little less enjoyable for me, if that makes any sense. Because now I'm kind of like, okay, well, did this story serve any purpose other than serving as a connection to the Dark Tower? Or is it just one of those things where King was like, oh, hey, I have all these Dark Tower stories in mind, so let me just give you a random piece and not label it as a Dark Tower book.
Yeah, I can totally see that, because I think how well the ending works for you and like the underarching structure of why the story is happening. Because you're right, this is very much a, on a certain level, this is very much a explanation of a character in the Dark Tower.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like a story about Ralph, because the story isn't directly about the person. It feels like it's kind of trying to work at two purposes, you know? It's trying to like tell two stories at the same time almost, and it's really going to depend on how it works for you. Because, and I liked it, but I do read a lot of fantasy novels. I went through a period of reading a lot of epic fantasy, you know, like big tomes. So it wasn't, and they do that a lot in fantasy books. It is not unusual to have kind of multiple purposes going in a story. So okay. For me, it was like, oh, okay, I see. We're trying to world build and tell a whole complete story. And it's a real toss up of how well it's going to work for the individual.
Yeah, because the grounded parts of the story certainly take place in Derry. So then you're like, okay, maybe this has more than just the connection with Mike being part of the It story. And then it kind of doesn't go that direction. And once the Greek mythology came into it, I was like, I don't know any of these names. So there's probably a lot that I'm missing here. So I'm glad that you have clarified some of that for me. And then the character in question for the Dark Tower is Patrick Danville. And he appears in this book and then in The Dark Tower, which is book 7 of the series, which you said is the last book. It's not the last published book, but the one after is like a space between books 4 and 5. So, you know, he just released it out of order for whatever reason. But as far as I know, that is the end of the Dark Tower series. So the fact that I'm going to now have to wait like, I don't know, 20 more books, give or take, before I get to that. I don't think it's 20, but it's pretty close. So I have quite some time before I'm going to get to it. And that's probably how people who read these books as they were being released felt, because there's a huge gap between this and that Dark Tower book.
Right. And I mean, this was published in 1994. And when was the Dark Tower? Like you said, it's like 20 books. And I mean, I think this would have been after the fourth one, but before the big rush of the last three that happened, because he didn't publish any Dark Tower books for quite some time. And then he had his car accident.
And then he did 3 back to back to back.
Right. And I think that was from what I've read, I think it's in On Writing. He talks about that he realized like, oh shit, I better finish this series.
Just in case.
Right. And so there's at least 10 years, if not more, space between this and the last Dark Tower. So it's very interesting to me that this character was set up so long in advance, because it would have been weird if he didn't use it. But that's a lot of setup for something that doesn't come to fruition for an incredibly long period of time. And from the from what the Atropos and Clothos and Lachesis tell him, like, it's kind of clear that King knew what he was going to use this character for. It wasn't just like, oh, well, we'll just tell this interesting story. It's like he had a plan of like, okay, this character, you know, Patrick has this purpose that he needs to get taken care of. So we'll tell the story of his life being saved so he can fulfill that purpose.
Yeah, and you were right. It was 10 years. So books 6 and 7 both came out in 2004, and book 5 came out in 2003. So he really just like cranked out the material. And from what I can tell from the Gunslinger book, he knew what story he was going to tell, because in the early books, he kept saying, you know, the story will continue. So obviously he had this idea in his head for years upon years, because the gap between the Gunslinger being released in 82 all the way to the series quote unquote ending in 2004, that's a big gap. That's a lot of years. That is 22 years. And then you have the Wind Through the Keyhole, which came out even later in 2012. So to really get the entire story, people had to wait 30 years. So that's just crazy for a series to drag on that long. And it's because King was putting out so many other things. He didn't want the Dark Tower to be his only thing he was working on.
Right. That man's head is obviously just stuffed with ideas that are constantly begging, like demanding to be released. And, you know, with that kind of book, or that kind of series rather, you have to be so careful with what you're doing, because it usually has to come at the right time. It's hard to just force that to come out and have it come out right, especially for someone who's constantly coming up with new ideas and like, oh, well, I really want to write this book now. And then I want to write this book now. And he just didn't get back to it. And I think my guess would be by the time he hit the fourth book, he was like, oh God, this is really complicated. I'll just put it off and keep putting it off and keep putting it off until like, okay, I better finish this because I might die type of situation. And I think that, but he still kind of like gives us little tidbits from this and Rose Matter and it's a few other books later on in the series or in his collection of writings, as it were.
Yeah, I definitely found Ralph and Lois as a team very compelling. And like I mentioned earlier, that's sort of what kept me going with this story, because I was so invested in those two. By the time you had the little bald doctors playing a bigger role in Atropos. So you have this buildup that makes you like these characters. And I think that's something that King does so well, because if I didn't like Ralph and Lois, other than this podcast, I would not have had a ton of incentive to want to finish that book, especially with it being as long as it is.
Yeah, I think they're so compelling. They're so interesting. And like I said, they're so different. Like you just don't get to see these kind of people who, and as always, he writes people who are different than him, because obviously he was not 70 when he wrote this book. Mm-hmm. Quite a ways away from it at that point. But yet they feel so lived in, as most of his characters do. And I just wanted to know. And I think it was really good idea to start us getting to know Ralph with the death of his wife, because when you see someone in a book who's going through that kind of trauma, like you get to know them on this very deep, vulnerable level pretty quickly, because you're seeing how they're reacting to all of this pain, and it makes us feel for Ralph and want him to feel better. And then he gets the insomnia and he just starts to go downhill from there. And it's like, God, I just want this guy to have a win. He's got to have a win, right? You know, and then his relationship, his and Lois's relationship with Bill McGovern, who's Ralph's downstairs neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love how the three of them have the relationship between the three of them and how they all interplay with each other, because McGovern is so different from the two of them. So it allows them to bounce off of him and creates little conflicts to keep us going as we're building to the bigger conflict.
Exactly. And a lot of what I enjoyed about this has to do with how King structured the story as a whole, but also just the various character arcs within the story. Like you said, if we didn't start off with seeing the trauma that Ralph had gone through and how he was suffering with the insomnia and everything like that, we wouldn't have cared as much about his story and how it led him to Lois, how it led him to ultimately in the end his sacrifice, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But just the way King writes characters, he really knows where to drop them in the story. It's like, okay, we're going to give you this character who has been through this horrible thing and is struggling so much to get over it because of this other thing that came about because of it.
Right. Right. And that it gives us such a reason to root for him. And I think in particular, I think one of the things I've really loved about Ralph's character is how he interacts with Ed Deepnow, who's the puppet of the puppet in this scenario. He's Atropos's human puppet. And how immediately Ralph is like, I've got no time for you once Ed, you know, because we see Ed in the very beginning of the book where he's acting completely out of character. And
he's got some road rage going.
Yeah. And cursing and hitting this guy who's much bigger than him. And Ralph kind of helps diffuse the situation. But then that all gets kind of lost once, you know, his wife dies, which is like the next scene. And then we see where Ed has beaten Helen, and she, the scene where she is walking after he's horrifically beaten her and she's walking with her baby, and how Ralph becomes so enraged, despite his age, you know, a 70-year-old man, again, goes to confront this like early 30s dude who literally just beat the shit out of his wife and knows he shouldn't do it, but can't stop himself because he just is so outraged by this injustice and this this hurt that's been perpetrated against this person, Helen, who he obviously like cares a lot for. I get the impression he kind of like loves her like a daughter.
Yeah.
By the end of the book. And that is such a brave thing for him to do. And King deals a lot in abuse, in particular domestic violence against women, and he's never afraid to show it be really terrible and show people being incredibly upset about it. And that is, you know, that's the reaction they should have. And that Ralph is his voice in this is very powerful, I think.
And his sacrifice for Natalie just makes the character even more of a powerful presence in this story because he's clearly nearing the end of his life. You know, anyone who is over 70, you're always kind of like, oh boy, you know, we've hit that spot where you're not really sure how much time someone has left. And the fact that Ralph has sort of been given this second life, so to speak, by serving this purpose, I think is something that makes him feel like a younger character than he is by the end, especially when he makes that sacrifice for Natalie.
Right. And that's set up so well. So well, because like it, the setup for it where he refuses to choose. He refuses to, you know, choose between saving the little boy that this is all about and saving his surrogate granddaughter and daughter is just kind of casually tossed off. Like, it's just mentioned, like, oh, the promise, the agreement. And then it's, you know, the final scenes of the book. And it is, like, it comes back to you, like, oh, damn, that's right. What was the promise? What were the details of this promise? Because it never really goes into it. It's, you know, it said that Atropos is going to cause an accident for Natalie. But how they're going to stop that is never mentioned. At that time, we don't find that out until the very end. And that it was like a, even though I've read this book a couple times, there was this dawning realization of what was coming. And it was like, oh, my heart. Cause I felt like Ralph sacrificed a lot, man. I feel like he should get more than like 5 or 6 years.
You really do feel for his character at the end, and you're still grateful for sort of this time he was able to have, even though, you know, we're just the readers of this story. And I really just like how his character arc went from start to finish. I didn't see any real flaws with that part of the story. And like I said, a lot of the reason I didn't like this as much as you did was because of the elements that I just didn't have enough knowledge about to understand better. And I feel like with fantasy, that's bound to happen, because at least with something like, you know, Harry Potter, a lot of it was just completely made up, witches, wizards, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of lore behind those things. And same goes for Lord of the Rings. I felt like the stories themselves were just a little easier for me to understand. And obviously, one being a kid's series of books, even right. though plenty of adults like them, and Lord of the Rings being something a little deeper than that. Those are sort of the main two that I am familiar with. And honestly, I have not read all of the Lord of the Rings books, so a lot of what I know comes from the movies, which maybe isn't the best place to get all of my information from.
Oh, no, they're very good. I've read the Lord of the Rings series like 7 times until...
I've read The Hobbit.
No, the movies... The Hobbit is great, but the Lord of the Rings, the three, The Fellowship, Two yeah. Towers, and Return of the King are really dense, and... They're amazing, but they are not for everyone.
Like, I'm starting to see a theme of towers here in fantasy novels.
Yes. Yes, there's lots of towers in fantasy novels. There's a tower
and
in
castles.
Return of the King, too. Yes, lots of castles, lots of keeps. Yeah, I think there is a lot of, I don't know, what's the word? Tropes? That's the word. Tropes okay. in fantasy, like towers that... King kind of taps into in this book a little bit. Yeah, if you don't have that pre-knowledge, I think this one is definitely one where he doesn't do a lot of hand-holding. Like, and usually in his books, he's a little more, like, explanatory.
Uh-huh.
And in this one, I think he kind of just throws you into it and says, figure it out.
It's a little more in the shadows in comparison to a lot of the other things he's written as far as the Dark Tower goes. But it was definitely interesting to kind of think through this after the fact and be like, okay, I kind of see where this went. I think I ended up giving this a 3 out of 5 overall, which isn't horrible. It's just it wasn't one of my favorite things because I didn't understand it right off the bat. So is there anything else you want to bring up before we go?
I did want to talk about Derry just a little bit. And like,
okay,
what was it like for you going back to Derry? Because I think this is the first book since It that's set in Derry and that we really get a yeah. good picture of it. And since Derry is such a big part of it, you know, it's a character in and of itself. How did you feel going back and seeing like essentially the ramifications of what the end of It is or what the ending of It brings?
I was kind of nervous because, like I said, I didn't know if there were going to be more connections beyond bringing up Mike Hanlon a few times, and if, you know, something weird was going to happen and there were like remnants of Pennywise still, which I think would have been interesting in a sense, because then it would mean the It story wasn't completely over. And given how much people love that story, I'm a little surprised King didn't do something along those lines, but just to see the town and how it's not in the best of shape, it's kind of like, you know, not to the extent of the aftermath of Carrie, but maybe to the extent of the aftermath of Needful Things for Castle Rock. That's kind of what it felt like to me. It's like, okay, this town just had this major thing happen, and it's going to take a long, long time for it to get back to normal if it ever does.
Yes, that's how I felt too. It's like the Needful Things comparison, that was totally how I felt. Like, oh, this is, you know, it's picking up the pieces and there's not very many pieces left. You yeah. know, it's kind of trying to like hold water in a sieve almost. And I really like that he said it in Derry, because of, if you've read It, you have all this history behind it and you know what Ralph has experienced at least a little bit, because mm-hmm. 70, I was trying to figure out, I was like, okay, how old would he have been during Pennywise? Because I think he would have lived through at least 2 Pennywise.
Yes.
And so.
Yeah, because I believe it ended in like 85, and before that it was like 58. So he would have definitely been alive for both of these, given that this came out in 94. He would have been, you know, in his 20s, I believe, in 58, and then, you know, 27 years later, closer to his 50s, give or take.
Right. And so that means he probably wasn't right in the path of Pennywise, but I do think it would have meant that he was maybe alive for the big massacre that happens in the middle of the street.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that was really interesting to kind of think back about what would these people's lives have been like. And they talk about playing on Niebolt Street.
Yeah.
And the old train yard. And it was just... It was so many interesting little recalls. And there is the mention with Ed Deepnose's ring that feels like it's been invested with all this poisonous energy that falls into the sewers. And he has this line about, like, it wasn't found for a long time, but things that go into the sewers in Derry have an unpleasant way of coming back or something like that. And I was like, ooh, chills.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought that was just another layer of interesting background that we get this glimpse of Derry without it, like you said, directly tying into Pennywise.
It gives us a good sense of what the town has become like, and you don't need to know or have read it before reading this necessarily, just to get the sense that this town has been through a lot. And I like that he makes that obvious in this, because it's hard when you have so many different connections in the Stephen King universe. I believe I've showed you that crazy poster where it's just like lines going to every single thing. And you're just like, oh, yep, my goodness, this is way too many connections to keep up with. And I know one of my goals with this podcast was to read through everything chronologically and sort of see what I could see reading everything so closely together. Because, like I said, for anyone who was following his career from the start, they had much longer waits between books. I'm basically just doing, you know, one right after the other. There are very few times during this process where I have not been reading a King book. So it's just kind of like one after the other. So even though I feel like in some ways that might be a little bit of a hindrance just because I have to go through them so quickly. I mean, I don't have to, I'm choosing to. But it's one of those things where it's interesting what I've caught on to and what I've maybe missed with some of the connections.
Yeah, yeah. It gives you an interesting perspective. And that's something that there probably aren't a whole lot of people who have it, who were living it as it happened. You know, I'm sure there are more than a few people who, oh, new King book is out, I have to read it.
Given how much money he's made and how many books he's sold, there's probably multiple people who have done that.
Yes, but to catch every single book and read every single one in the same order, like that is a feat. Or to rather catch every single King related product, because you're not just reading the books, you're watching most of the movies. You know, those Children of the Corns are, we've brushed those off now.
I have one more and then I'm done.
Yes.
One more and then I'm done with those. But yeah, it's one of those things where there's just so much volume that, you know, there are some people who don't like fantasy, so they aren't going to read the Dark Tower series, but they'll read these other books not realizing they tie in with the Dark Tower. And then I know some people who like fantasy but don't like horror, so they only read the Dark Tower books. So I think King offers this flexibility to where you don't have to like everything he does to be a fan of some of his writing.
Right. The stories that come to him can be for everyone. Or you can just read something like, you know, The Green Mile. Like, The Green Mile has very little supernatural stuff in it. Or his short story collections. You know, he has stuff that's not horror.
Shawshank.
Yeah, Shawshank and The Body. I wouldn't necessarily classify The Body as a horror story. It's much more like a coming of age with some creepy elements thrown in. So yeah, he writes stuff for everyone, and it's great when you can read bits and pieces of all of it and kind of get a sense of how wide-ranging his talents are and how many different kinds of stories he can tell.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Katie, I think that wraps up this discussion here. Thank you again for explaining some things to me that I didn't catch on to while I was reading the book. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, it was a pleasure talking with you too. And again, this is one of my favorites, so I really loved getting a chance to discuss it.
Of course. And quickly before we go, I want to let you all know that you can support the podcast on Patreon. You'll get a thank you on the show with the $1 a month tier. For $2 a month, you'll get a Chat Summit Terry sticker sent to you. You can follow us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook now. As always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.